The Lutheran Church in its confessions has made it the public ratification of the acceptance of a call to a certain congregation. It becomes very important. A call to a certain congregation. Even though the call from that congregation may be blank, and the district president writes in the name, or the district president and the dean of students, and who else is on the faculty committee for the assignment, put in the name. You must call specific to a specific congregation. If we should choose to make it something else, there is no divine law against it. That is to say, this order is de jure humano. It is an adioperant, which means it is subject to the goodwill and the thought and agreement of pious Christian men and women. That's an adioperant. We can decide how to do it. That's agreeable. We might ordain the graduates at our theological seminaries and by such ordination give them the church's public testimony of their fitness for the ministerial office. We might do that, he says. Ordain them at the seminary and thus give them their testimony of fitness for the office. This, however, we already do when we hand them their diploma upon graduation from the seminary. The sectarian naughtiness to the church, which Walter saw by taking the examination and the ordination away from each other and having them done either by the congregation that calls or by somebody not appointed for that from the church, is already assumed practice by Fritz's time. When I was authorized to be ordained, I never even met my district president face to face. He signed the document. Were any of you examined by your district president for even 15 minutes before you were authorized to be ordained? Raise your hands, those who were. Kukamal! Let's stop bellyaching about Elka for a while, shall we? The notion that there was an examination and that was related to ordination, and it was by parties who had no vested interest, is a very old notion, a very substantial notion, was practiced in the churches until Missouri got its new teacher of the church, namely the seminary, a new bishop. The seminary has become the bishop. Now, I propose to you that the seminary is incompetent to establish that a man is qualified to be ordained. They are competent to do the teaching, and they ought to give attention to the spiritual life and growth of the men there. That's their work. But when it comes time to examine the candidate who shall be ordained, it must not be the seminary, and it must not be the congregation who has a vested interest. It must be godly men and women together with godly pastors who will examine the candidate. My proposal for examination is a 5-day examination. And that it be a thorough one with regard to preaching. How do you treat this case? How would you do in that case? Catechize for us. What is your understanding of doctrine? Tell us what you do with the penitent. A real examination so that the church can say, axios, he's worthy to be ordained. Now, this, Fritz gives us permission to do this. If in any case our practice ought to conform to a definite understanding that we have in reference to the meaning of ordination. Until now, ordination has meant what our confessions state it to be. And then he quotes the smell called articles. Dr. Nagel, he doesn't quote the section that you said was snipped out. And he makes it a kind of minimalistic thing. Why, even they say that, you know, our pastors just get together and ordain somebody. When that was an emergency situation, saying what Cyprian said to the Pope back in Epistle 67, keep your cotton-picking fingers out of Spain. Those pastors and congregations can ordain their own bishops over there. Now, this becomes a minimalistic permission. All right, what is it to be called, ordained, and licensed? Before I enter that, I want to say one more thing. Another one of the elements that I think must be absolutely altered, absolutely, is that the seminary must be forbidden to recruit students. They must not be allowed to recruit students. They have too much vested interest in warm bodies. The church must be the one who gathers her candidates. And we must do that when they're little, tiny kids. By the time my black kids in Chicago hit 5 years old, all they could dream about was Walter Payton and $1.5 million a year. You know, the ministry, that the pastoral office, that wasn't in their mind. We must start early, but it must be the church. And secondly, we must see to it that the people who ask money of us who are graduates of those schools don't act as if we are outsiders who've never heard anything about the school, who have no interest in the pastoral work or in the mission evangelism work of the church. In other words, we must choke those who are in charge of the money raisers, choke off that pattern, and learn by generosity to sustain our men, not only at the seminary, but to sustain them en route. I have proposed for the black congregations, I have proposed a way that we would shepherd a candidate from the time he was a high schooler or a grade schooler, shepherd him all the way through to ordination, so that members of his own congregation would say to him, say to the ordaining congregation, he is worthy. Now to be called, I want to make a distinction. It is the distinction that I try to set in a very simple way, because I'm simple in that respect, with regard to the Augsburg Confession, a legal document pitted it within a legal situation, up for judgment. Well, what we want to do is wipe you out by church and state. And within that, the form and the content of the Holy Gospel, the truth of God, confessed not only the way us Lutherans believe it, you know, every little Jack Horner sits in the corner eating his Christmas pie, sticks in his thumb, pulls out a plum and says, what a good boy am I. But a Catholic confession, this is what the world ought to believe. And come now and believe it. I use the words now with regard to ordination canonically. There are laws in Holy Scripture about who is to be considered for the pastoral office. There are laws and regulations in the churches, appropriately so. They are canonical. They have a place. We are not a mob of everybody doing what is right in his own eyes, which is what we have become virtually. But when we talk about ordination canonically, we are not talking about ordination evangelically. We must not say, oh, we will talk evangelically and not canonically. If you lose one, you've lost both. Take away the key of absolution, and the key of closing is superfluous. Take away the key of excluding, and the key of absolution is contemptible. It's nothing. You can always tell, says Vilmar, what the church thinks of herself at any moment by the way she uses the office of the keys. So there must be evangelical consideration of ordination and call, and there must be a canonical consideration of it. Now, what do we mean, what do I mean when I say canonical? I mean those canonical things that are required in the apostolic epistles and are stated in the ordination services, the liturgies, where we do what we confess. They are the regulations. It is a regulation that require an oath. You swear an oath. Will you? And you swear it before God and His Holy Church. That is a canonical requirement. But all of the personal styles and qualifications of the person, and all of the oaths stacked upon top of each other, are not one whit the energy for which the pastor is ordained. You heard that beautifully from both of the lectures before. For the hearing of faith, Romans 1, or the obedience of faith. And for such a faith God has established. The only thing that creates faith is the holy and apostolic gospel. which is nothing else but an exposition of the New Testament of our Lord's sacrifice, victory, and sacramental feeding. But what we call for canonically is the oath that A, the pastor is bound to use nothing else than the gospel to do his work in the church. And B, he is bound under orders to see to it that the church is never allowed to lust after some other power. He's like Odysseus going between Scylla and Charybdis, tied to the mast, ears stuffed with wax, gag in his mouth. And he said, no matter what I say, threaten, do, sail right straight through. So the people in the church may want, in goodwill, something else. The pastor's ordination is that he is under orders, canonically, to see to it that the life of the congregation is never ordered by anything else than the Holy Gospel. The authority to ordain, then, is the authority to put a human being under such orders. But with Dr. Fritz, I confess and agree gladly, there is no divine law that you must ordain a pastor. Where does the authority to ordain derive? It derives from the call that Christ and his church have uttered. That's why I said it's important to know what we mean by the call. A week ago, in some conversation with some stout, old, faithfully confessing Lutheran Christians in a Bible study, they were musing about this and that person, and one pastor who had resigned, he had a broken heart, resigned from the holy ministry. One of the doughty old ladies said, well, you know, a man going into the pastoral office later in his life, I just don't know whether he has that call. And then she referred to another pastor who said, he knew since he was 5 years old that he had to be that he wanted to be a pastor. And then she pointed her hand to me and said, I heard you tell the story about when you were a lad. What did she think the call was? That internal conviction. Here I am, and the church ought to really accept me. Aren't you a naughty old church if you won't take me? That's not what we're talking about with the call. Now, I see a problem here. The argument in Chemnitz and in Walther that's a very strong argument is that the authority to ordain lies in the call. And they argue, Chemnitz and Walther with him, that the church is the bride of Christ, and therefore the whole household is turned over to her, the way a man turns his household over to his wife. And therefore she can hire the servants or fire the servants or tell them what she wants them to do or not do. Well, I suggest to you that if the bride of Christ is like that, she has become a liberated woman and is fighting with her husband. Because there is not some autonomous life that the church has to do what she wants. She is in union as the servant and united beloved with this Lord. But nevertheless, the call is the grounding, the authority, the foundation on which we say to this or that candidate, we put you under orders. The ordering of the church can be done by retribution. You can learn the principles of growth, of management, of counseling. They can all be learned. And you can buy bumper stickers or little Bible verses printed on gummed labels and stick them all over the plan. But it is still the law. The unforgiving servant was ordered to pay up. And when the unforgiving servant would not order his life anew by that mercy, that freely flowing mercy, then he himself became the victim of the law he lived by. So that the office of the ministry, the ordination to the pastoral office, is the putting under orders, canonically, a human being whose orders are, you may not order the church, and the church may not, you may not allow the church to be ordered by anything else than this gospel of the Passover lamb. We live in a real problem time. We live in the time not only where there's the confusion of language, but we live in a time where the extraordinary has become the ordinary. Within the church, I see this preeminent in two areas besides church government and church form. The one is in pastoral care. The ordinary instruments for pastoral care, preaching, catechesis, study, private confession and absolution, the administration to the people of the body and blood of the Lord, those are all really kind of facade come-ons to the real work that goes on in the counseling and the support groups. The extraordinary has become the ordinary. The same is true in much of worship. And so it is in that setting now that I want to talk about a different way of thinking of the ordering. First, Dr. Weinrich said, the order is an expression of the Word enfleshed. I don't want to drag him into what I say. I think I'm agreeing with him. But given the confession, the justification by grace through faith, the Holy Gospel preached and believed is the way God creates, sustains, and glorifies His people, His church. Then the expression of that, the social appearance of that, is that the office of preaching the gospel is alone and the only office ordained. To make a whole series of them, as if they were all the same, because everyone has a ministry, is to say that one Christ and one article is no longer central. But, now here's the hooker. Where you have this freedom of God in creating holy people out of sinners who are his enemies and who are reconciled to him by Christ. Where that faith is alive, there, love is like the womb of a fertile woman. It brings forth many labor, many works. So that the diakonia to faith is the one word of the gospel. The diakonia of love is a multiple, many-faceted life growing out of that one word. All of the offices that we call the Nebenämter, the teaching and the directors of this and that, and the people who take care of the buildings, the ones who care for the sick, the ones who care for the poor, the service of love around that is all nurtured by that life of faith, which in turn is nurtured upon that word. Therefore, it seems to me that in the present situation, we have four big problems. The first one is the pastor. We do not want to be submissive. We want to be associate pastors, senior pastor administration, junior pastor, this and that. We have all of these terms that have been multiplied about us. And he who does not know how to submit will not know how to supervise. He will not know how to be an episcopus. Secondly, we have forgotten an episcopus is one who is watching over the function of priests. The royal priesthood is where your episcopacy begins and where it's to be carried out. The only true bishop elected by the Holy Spirit is the pastor of the congregation. All other are by human right. I'm not too interested in what we do with those others. To give them the name bishop might only increase the naughtiness. But the bishop of the congregation must see to it that the life of those priests is engaged in listening to God and in speaking to God, prayer, and in teaching the neighbor. Those are the things that priests do, and the episcopus sees to it that the priesthood is busy. The third problem we have is, I think, with the word ordained. The ordination to the pastoral office I have described as putting under orders within a certain specific way. If we have any non-seminary people who are doing pastoral work, I urge that they be ordained. Seminary training is not a requirement, a canonical requirement for being a pastor. My proposal is, the way I've proposed it at Zion and in St. Paul, and I would like to advocate it, Dr. Wallenberg likes the idea, Dr. Patelko has also not rebuked me for it, that they would be, those presbyters would be canonically limited to the congregation where they were chosen from and where they were working. They wouldn't carry that ordination to a roster or to some other congregation. There would be the canonical limitation, and they would always be under the episcopus. And that would be an aggravation again of the first problem of the pastor. The pastor must stop being such a promoter and be again a man of prayer, a man of study, a man who is teaching. He's got to be teaching his presbyters and his deacons and his congregation. He is the bishop, the teacher. The fourth thing is the ordination to the diaconate. I have a very doughty opponent to this right in my own house. My wife thinks it's not a good idea. The ordination to the diaconate. I had advocated this in 1965 already first. Because the problem with the IRS and the problem of how we're going to designate teachers, how we're going to designate this group and that group, is getting downright laughable. One can hardly find his way through the Lutheran annual. And now we're going to add a new one, I guess. Lay pastors. Whoopee. Alice in Wonderland. But the ordination into the diaconate would have two things at its center. One, the diaconate, the life of the service of love, whether that's teaching, counseling, serving the sick or the dying, whatever it is, would be anchored within its submission to the office of pastor. And that ought to be liturgically expressed so that the deacons and deaconesses would have public function also. Secondly, what would be done in the diaconate would be specified in the call to enter that, to the teacher, to the social worker, or whatever. In a very short time, I have tried to give you what I think is the best I know and understand. I hope it is some use to you for clarification. And if I have hurt you or have caused pain to you, let me know about it, will you? The peace of the Lord be with you.